This is the Rich Duncan Construction Newsmakers at Noon with Denise and Hunter. Presented by Hagen Hamilton Insurance. Live local talk that matters to you. Now, here are Denise and Hunter, exclusively on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Welcome, everybody, to this Thursday edition of Newsmakers at Noon. I am Denise Quinn.
And this is Hunter Newton.
You know, it has been a long week. I'm glad it's over.
That's right. Well,
we've had technical challenges and weird crap going on all week.
Well, you know, we're in this day and age where, you know, everything we do is so based on technology. And the one thing technology can't deal with real well is weather challenges and Mother Nature.
Yes, exactly. And I've been wondering, you know, about internet issues and then windstorms and rain. And I was telling you, Hunter, before we came on, we had a tree snap on our property last night. And I'm kind of freaked out about that because if it had fallen one way, it would have pretty much taken everything out. But instead, it fell the other way. So thank you, Lord, for that. So
somebody is looking over you.
I know. I praise God that it fell the way that it did. But it's still kind of, you know.
I'm impressed you slept through it. That's the impressive part to me.
I didn't hear it. Well, I have like little earbuds in because I can't sleep. So I was probably listening to like a Matt Walsh podcast or something when it happened. Anyway, we're going to jump right in. It is Thursday and we want to welcome to the show our friend James Masnoff, Dispatches from the Swamp. James, how are you?
I am good. How are you?
I am good. Well, a little stressed out, as you can tell.
Yeah, we made then, it, you know, like right down to the wire.
I know. Connectivity, because you're over in the East Coast, you're in the swamp. And so we've got to use technology to get all that done. And this one was a little close, but hey, we always make it work. So anyway, just James, for those who don't remember, James is a writer, a musician, a historian, a professor. He's a Renaissance man. He's back east in Virginia.
Yes. Alexandria, just outside of D.C.
Just outside of D.C. So we have him on periodically to talk about what's happening there. And before we get started, though, I did want to today is December 11th, and so I wanted to wish both you guys a happy National Have a Bagel Day. Oh. And I know, James, you're back east. The bagels are better back there. They're just better.
It's true. Yep. I'm sorry, but it is true. And it is totally I didn't even realize this. So as soon as we're done here, I'm going to have to run out and get a bagel.
Go have a bagel. Have a bagel. And then you can, while you're also at it, it's also National Tango Day. So, you know, maybe a little
tango
up to the counter.
Tango for a bagel.
There was a coffee shop somewhere that did something where if you came in and you did a little dance in their little square, they give you a free coffee. So maybe this, yeah, do a tango, get a free bagel.
You probably need to include the third one on this list, which is a National Christmas Jumper Day.
Right. So now you know what a jumper is. It's a sweater.
No, it's like a full little like outfit with, you know, the ones that bought you had the little buttons in the back.
See, that's what we call jumpers, but in the UK, a jumper is a sweater.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
I'd rather wear a sweater than a onesie, Hunter.
I think it would be hilarious to have James, you know, when we're done, put on his the onesie and head on down to Tango his way to get a bagel. I mean, just the vision alone is terrific.
It's there waiting for me.
It is. And we're waiting for video. We need video. All right. Enough of that. So we talked, I think last week, we had our friend Jeff Reynolds on from Restoration News. And a lot of people are really excited about this, the Ken Burns Revolutionary War documentary. I know I was. I'm not so much anymore. And we talked about it a little bit with Jeff and sort of where Ken Burns just forgot about God. But from an historical perspective, we wanted to talk to you, James, and get your take on it. I have a number of friends who started watching it and it was like, this is crap. And it was boring. And again, I've said I loved earlier Ken Burns. I loved the Civil War documentary. I watched a little bit of the baseball one. It was good. So I'm disappointed to hear this. So we wanted to get your take on it. Have you seen it? And what do you think about it?
Yes, watched the whole thing, and I think there's reason for different people to not like certain things about it. There are also things that I did like about it. So I would agree that the role of God or Christianity in the life of the founders and really all Americans at that time, virtually all Americans at that time, is certainly glossed over. That's nothing new with these kinds of works, and that's not to give an excuse. I guess that's just one of the things I was less surprised by.
Yeah. Okay. I think you're right. I mean, he's a of the left, And so it's not surprising. A lot of people were saying that there's a lot of TDS in there, Trump derangement. I don't know. Again, I haven't watched it. I may, though, just out of curiosity. So just as far as what did he get right?
Well, I think he got a lot of things right. The role of sort of Native Americans and war with Native Americans is no small part of the revolution, the American founding. And I do think that that's something that I saw, like, Mount Walsh's take and some other people's. And that's one of the things that they didn't like about it. Look, I come at this from as a historian. And, you know, if you're going to look at the history objectively, that's just part of the history.
Well, real quick, was there a complaint that it was included, or was that what was their angle on it?
It should be included.
You're right. It's part of our history.
I guess it depends. I'm not sure. I just know that some people on the sort of conservative side, from Mount Walsh to is it Rich Lowry at National Review? He was another one.
Yep.
And look, what I think Ken Burns gets wrong here, that I did hear some of those people that I mentioned have a problem with, is the overstating of the role of the Iroquois, or the Haudenosaunee as their original sort of confederation name. But the Iroquois confederation and its influence on what becomes the United States. It is true, and it's in the documentary, that in the 1750s, on the eve of the French and Indian War, Benjamin Franklin proposes what's called the Albany Plan. Why don't the colonies unite as a confederation the way the Iroquois has done? So that is true, but it gets rejected. And when decades later, during the Revolution, after the Revolution, the idea for a confederation is sort of revitalized, and it happens in 1787 in Philadelphia, the Iroquois are never mentioned. So it's something that Ken Burns takes a historical fact from the 1750s, and he then moves it as though it is an influence in the 1780s when it's not.
Okay. You know, and that's the thing. Documentaries, I know when I was younger, I would take them as sort of gospel. Well, I saw this in a documentary. It must be true.
Yeah.
So I suppose with any documentary, with anything that you're watching, you know, take it with a grain of salt. And it really should spur you to do more research on your own if it's something that's really interesting to you and fascinates you.
Oh, absolutely. And if I can try to be a little bit fair here, I am going to offer a mild criticism to my conservative friends, which is this. I do think that Ken Burns gets some things wrong. I just noted one of the most important things he gets wrong really early in the documentary. Not only do I still think that people should watch it, including conservatives, I think we should be happy that there's a New England liberal out there who is to some degree patriotic. And I have tried to tell particularly my college students over the years now, you know, it is a mistake for conservatives to act like they're the only ones capable of patriotism. It's wrong for liberals and progressives to let them do that. And there was a time not too long ago when liberals were capable of expressing patriotism.
Yes.
That's gone away in especially the past 10, 20 years. I think this is a rare moment where a liberal figure like Ken Burns is doing so. He gets some of the history wrong. I'm admitting that.
Okay.
This is also a bridge to be sort of taken advantage of. And it's part of my disappointment in people like Matt Walsh and others who I think they should express their criticism of Ken Burns and this documentary, but also be happy that there's actually a liberal out there, a public liberal out there, who's actually celebrating America's history, even if he gets some of it wrong.
Fair enough. And I'm really glad you made that point, especially with next year being the 250th anniversary, and to have that and to get that back and to get it back into the forefront, especially in schools. So I take that. I agree with what you said, actually. I think you're right. And far too often we want to stand in our camps and our factions and point fingers and kind of scold. And I don't think we need to do that. And it's good that, you know, acknowledging that some things were not handled correctly. I'm looking at this other article and talking about leaving out Judeo-Christian values.
Yeah.
Okay. But we know that. We know that going into it.
Yeah. Right. It's absolutely true. And my take on this is not to be uncritical
yeah.
of Ken Burns and his version of the history. I think those critiques are important. And in the world of historians, that's what we do. We criticize each other's work all the time. In fact, that's what scholarship is
yeah.
here's, you know, I'm going to point to where this historian gets it wrong and this other historian has it right. And here's why. So that critique is important, including from people who are just consuming this version of the history. So my problem is not with the critiques. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, let's also have a sort of balance and be like, wow, there's a new documentary on the American Revolution, and it's not 1,000% negative, you know.
Yeah. We should celebrate that. Yay!
Yeah, I just come from the perspective and the things that I've heard. I haven't watched it either. I probably will now at this point. But
I probably will too.
Yeah. But I think it's the lack of the acknowledgement of Christianity playing the role, I think, is what starts it, and then they just kind of roller coaster from there. A lot of these you know, influential conservative, you know, podcasters.
Yeah, and it's a very damaging way for the documentary to start. I think it should start. It should have provided that context of how religious American colonists were. They were among the most Christian, the most the people with the most religious fervor anywhere in the world.
That's and why they were this, there.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. to this day, Americans are more religious than their European counterparts, and that is because of how religious people were during the colonial era and during the Revolution and the American founding.
Yeah, and I think he makes those assertions right within the first 5 minutes of the documentary, which is unfortunate, and a lot of people have focused on that. Well, I think that's fair enough, and I think your criticism is well rounded and it's fair. And I agree with you that when something like that, it is a bridge, and we might want to treat it as a bridge. I'm tired of factions. It just seems like everybody just retreats to their corners. I'm guilty of it too. I'm tired.
Sure.
It's exhausting. You know, this current climate and culture is exhausting. It really is.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, it is. And so it's good to have that reminder. All right, let's go ahead and take a break again. We're talking, this is Dispatches from the Swamp with James Masnoff. You're listening to Newsmakers at Noon on 1430 KYKN.
Now back to the Rich Duncan Construction Newsmakers at Noon with Denise Hunter, presented by Hagen Hamilton Insurance on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers at Noon is brought to you by the Pearland Mill in Home Comfort.
Alrighty, welcome back, everybody. So one of the other things, I mean, you wrote a book about SCOTUS, Rights Reign Supreme. And so, again, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson is in and out of the news for all kinds of interesting reasons. I'm not going to editorialize on that. I had to do a little research because you and I chatted before about some things we wanted to talk about. Honestly, with so much going on, that one hadn't really hit my radar, so I did do a little bit of research on it. Oy vey, James, oy vey. Let's talk about, now I've got a tweet up here, told the court that presidents should not be able to fire the PhDs and experts who run the government. And she even argued that presidents should avoid control over transportation and the economy. What the hell?
Yeah, it's a case. I don't remember the name of the case. It's
Trump v. Slaughter.
Okay, right. Thank you. Having to do with, can Trump remove somebody from the executive branch, particularly non-elected, you know, appointees? And to me, as a constitutionalist, it's like, how is this even a question? Like,
yeah.
Of course, the head of the executive branch has the power to fire somebody who's working for the executive branch. It's incredible to me. It just shows how deep the deep state has gotten, and how sort of over the past century the administrative state has gotten its tentacles into everything, that people would even wonder if the president has this power. And Ketanji Brown Jackson, Justice Jackson, recently during oral arguments basically made it sound like, well, the president shouldn't have such power because we rely on these experts, these appointed, unelected bureaucrats. They might be PhDs, they might be experts in certain fields. And the question, and the constitutional question that a Supreme Court justice should be asking, is who does have the power to remove that person if needed?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not the president,
then who?
And we're talking about the executive branch, who possibly would it be? And if her argument, I'm not saying it is, but if her argument is the legislative branch, well, then you have cross branches, and that's not our system. So it's just one more instance. It's far from the first where Justice Jackson has shown to have really very little constitutional knowledge.
But yet here she is, appointed for life. So now they're talking about, was she appointed by the auto pen, and does that make it null and void? Is there anything anybody can do? Because I think she's rather, this is ridiculous. I mean, Woodrow Wilson has got to be dancing a jig, and, you know, this is exactly what he wanted. It's,
well, he would, if he would be, if he hadn't been so racist.
Right.
There, okay.
Right.
They never mentioned that. Didn't he first screened, what was it? What was the first movie?
Birth of a Nation.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
He screened it at the White House.
The first movie screened in the White House was that piece of crap.
Yeah.
So anyway, auto pen. I mean, how valid is this? Is there anything we can do? This woman is, you know, very, very, I mean, different things that I've read about her, not impressed. And like you said, go ahead.
Not impressed at all. And I think she's just going to have to be fair to the small progressive wing on the bench. I have my criticisms of each of them, but she is a whole, you know, she's on a whole other level.
Yeah.
You know, I often disagree with Kagan. I sometimes disagree with Sotomayor, but even if I disagree with their conclusions, they have a knowledge of the constitutional interpretation at hand. Jackson just has no idea. She seems to be such a policy wonk, and it more in terms of like the minutiae of lower cases and sort of more policy oriented interpretations, that it doesn't seem like she has much constitutional knowledge at all, which is just absurd for her position.
It is, and it's rather frightening. And then you think about, too, if, oh, God forbid, the D's, the left, get back in control and always talk about packing the court, mm-hmm. they're going to pack it with a bunch of brown Jacksons.
That's the problem. And I heard, I think, was it Buck Sexton? It was somebody who also said, well, maybe she could be impeached or removed, not because of the auto pen, but because Biden clearly violated civil rights laws by saying, I'm going to appoint a black woman.
And right.
In any other scenario, that's against federal law. I think that's a novel idea. It won't mm-hmm. work. It won't work for a number of reasons. I think people, and I'm far from a fan of Justice Jackson, but just sort of the practical reality of it is, I think people need to move forward on it, accept that she's going to be there for quite a long time and have to bake that into whatever decisions they want to happen, because here's a sort of inconvenient truth for conservatives. President Reagan also said in the early 1980s that he was going to elect a woman or appoint a woman to the Supreme Court for the first time. And he got a lot of support for doing that with Sandra Day O'Connor.
Right.
So we need to have a sense of history here. And like, if Biden did that, it was sort of legally unethical. But you could say the same thing about Reagan in the 1980s with the decision that, I need to be clear, I think was a far better decision, clearly with Sandra Day O'Connor. But nevertheless, I don't think that's a winning argument to make. I thought it was a novel idea, but I don't think it'll work. And we just need to move forward knowing that Jackson is going to be on the bench for probably the next 20 years.
And right now she's in the minority as far as that with Sotomayor. And Sotomayor has got a lot of health issues, in my understanding. I mean, we don't.
True. Yeah.
So there could be a point where Trump could, you know, appoint somebody there. Not that I, you know, we don't wish any harm on her, any ill health.
No.
But
the other question around this Slaughter v. Trump case, I sit here and I go, the fact that is it the president's purview to fire people that work underneath him and replace them, because they don't have to be a PhD or an expert. They could just be Biden loyalists. I mean, that's literally, or Obama loyalists, or even Bush loyalists, whatever you want to call them. But I'm sitting here going, the fact that this made it to the Supreme Court to get these sound bites out of her, it tells you how screwed up the court system in this country truly is.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And also, and I say this as somebody who's, you know, pursuing my PhD, but, you know, a PhD doesn't make somebody qualified really for anything but their specific field. And even then you have to question it, because, you know, what are the fruits of their actions? you know, we have Anthony Fauci as an example of somebody, you know, a degreed, you know, scientist doctor who proved that he was completely out of his element, and he had his hands on the levers of policy, and he really damaged this country. So even the position of somebody having a PhD or something is not in and of itself a reason to have somebody there or a reason to keep them.
Yeah. You got to have a bow tie. Got to be the bow tie. That's the thing.
Well, that to me is the thing. I'm sitting here going for a year and a half, 2 years, all we got to hear was, you know, trust the experts. And now they can't even tell us what a woman is. Another Ketanji Brown Jackson quote.
Right. That should have been the big red. But yeah, Republicans confirm all these people. I mean, they there they are. It's the judicial activism that's very concerning, too, even on, you know, lower court benches and things like that, that has been just so frustrating. And again, depending on how the midterms turn out, we could see that ramp up big time, which is one more thing that's just exhausting.
I don't think that Republicans have been very good about choosing their battles. They could have fought harder on this one, and I have mixed feelings about it. But I mean, Democrats voted down appointees for the Supreme Court back in the 80s, and they did so successfully. So,
Come on, Republicans. Go ahead, Hunter.
Well, I was just going to say it's kind of along the lines of, you know, it's the first black woman. We can't go against that simply for optics. That's kind of my mentality.
Yeah.
And that's not our metric at all on that. All right, we're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Come on back.
The Rich Duncan Construction Newsmakers at Noon, presented by Hagen Hamilton Insurance, continues. Here are Denise and Hunter on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers at Noon is brought to you by Green Acres Landscape and GA at Home.
All righty. Welcome back, everybody. This Thursday, Friday Eve. That's the end of the busy broadcasting week for us. And we're closing out the week talking to James Masnoff with his monthly Dispatches from the Swamp. So, James, recently, obviously, we're hearing the news, and it was horrifying, the shooting of the two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C. Now, you're back there. Obviously, we're just reading about it and watching news and the talking heads talk about it. From your perspective, being back there, what's that been like?
Well, I mean, it was an absolute tragedy. And what really bothered me were the people who tried to blame this on Trump, as though wanting to bring some sense of peace and lowering the violence in D.C. was a bad idea.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous. I've told you a number of times as we've talked in recent months that it's been amazing in D.C. The lower crime, people are smiling, people are happy to be walking around. Mm-hmm. And so that event, honestly, I think that event says a lot more about the people that were brought into the country from Afghanistan upon Biden's withdrawal. I think it says a lot more about that and the need to vet. I understand that a lot of people are saying that the guy was radicalized after he got here. My response to that would be, well, what does that say?
Yeah.
You know, he was already unstable then. If somebody can be so easily radicalized, that's my take. But I mean, the shooting of the National Guard's people was completely tragic. And yet, since then, and just overall, DC is still so much better having that National Guard presence. It's still safer. You know, for the first time in a year, I saw somebody jump a turnstile at a metro station earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
But along with that, I saw something I had never seen before when in the past I had seen somebody do that. They got stopped, they got arrested, and they got taken away.
Boom. Yay.
So there you go.
Consequences.
So not only does the presence sort of mean that the National Guard are helping in sort of the day-to-day stuff. And I know that long-term overall, we don't necessarily want that, but it's a sort of interim policy. But it's also encouraging the local police to do their job.
Yeah.
And it's happening more and more. And I think people some people are learning the wrong lesson from what happened with that shooting. Like I said, I think it has a lot. That's much more a story about Biden's Afghanistan withdrawal mm-hmm. and how it was handled than anything to do with D.C., really, especially because the guy was from Bellingham, Washington. He wasn't local to Washington, D.C. at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brought up the concerns about vetting, because I don't remember the news source I was reading saying that the Biden had lowered the vetting standards. So they were even lower than what they were. And then my question is, how are you vetting somebody from Afghanistan? How do you do a background check? Do you know that what the vetting process is when somebody says these are the most vetted people? How do we know that? I mean, what do they look at? I don't understand. I don't know what it is. I don't know how rigorous. Apparently, if it was rigorous, it was lowered under Biden, and there were thousands of people brought in.
Yeah, well, that I don't know precisely, but I was listening to Mike Benz talk about this recently, and he noted, you know, the level of vetting that was done by the CIA, in Afghanistan, which, according to Mike Benz, the form of vetting by the CIA in Afghanistan was, what's your name? How old are you? Do you plan to, you know, be a traitor to the U.S. government? No? Okay, welcome in. You know, there was essentially no vetting at all, according to people like Mike Benz. So that, you know, that's all I know.
Okay, because, yeah, I don't know either, and I keep hearing, you know, certain saying that they are very well vetted. But then again, I don't know what the criteria is. I don't know how that's done. I don't know where it's done. I know a number of these individuals, when they were over there, they were helping us out over there. But that doesn't mean there's any loyalty to the United States just because they were helping us out. I remember when it all happened being just absolutely disgusted that so many of these people were left behind because of the very real danger with the Taliban filling that vacuum. So the whole thing was just an absolute colossal debacle.
Yeah. And I've seen some people, again, trying to blame Trump because I guess a sort of post-dated asylum approval for the guy happened since Trump became president again. And it's like, well, Trump can't micromanage every single document that passes the desk of a bureaucrat. And also, we're also well aware that there are people all over the administration and throughout the U.S. government who are rubber stamping policies that go back to the Biden years and the Obama years, for that matter. So the fact that this guy was rubber stamped asylum, you know, after the fact during Trump's presidency is not surprising and really doesn't reflect on Trump at all, in my opinion.
Okay. Is there, you know, because now the president, they paused indefinitely, immigration coming in. Obviously, illegal immigration is down because the border is closed. I mean, I don't know about the Canadian border, because that kind of... But is there, you know, just in talking with colleagues and people like that, how do people feel about that out there?
I don't know. In like the more progressive circles of academia, they're going to complain about Trump for any reason possible. Yeah. You know, as far as I'm concerned, though, it's long overdue. Like this idea that the United States should be open to all people, regardless of their worldviews and their philosophies and their ideologies. That's absurd. Mm-hmm. And it's something that the framers would have been very much against. The framers wanted large amounts of immigration at the beginning of the nation because they wanted to populate this country, particularly people from Western Europe. But, you know, really what it's about is that it's not a free-for-all for people to come in, because the whole idea is that, you know, I don't know if you remember the free state project of New Hampshire, of the idea of all these libertarians going to New Hampshire to try to sort of influence the state government there.
Yeah.
Well, that tells you that people know that when you populate an area with new migrations of people who think a certain way, they're going to influence the government there.
Right.
So we should very much, this isn't about skin color. This isn't necessarily about religion. This is a matter of, do you believe that people should live under freedom or not? And we have had our doors open as a country to all sorts of people who don't believe that for way too long.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can see it playing out in real time in Michigan. And in Minnesota.
Exactly.
And so you see that. And, you know, everyone, well, Reagan, that 86 amnesty kind of kicked it all off.
It did. And what did he and the Republicans get for it? You know, 30 more years of the problem. You know, this reminds me of like the school loan issue and all sorts of things. People have have their own pet answers to it. But if your answer doesn't actually solve the problem, then I don't want to hear it. You know, what I think what Reagan did was he granted amnesty at a time that he thought he was going to get the Democratic Congress that was in power to then agree to some sort of policy that secured the border. That never happened.
And it never happened.
Well, yeah, it didn't happen until Trump. Let's put it that way.
Right, right. It, you know, and politics is a lot of horse trading. We know that that happens, which is why people, it's like you look at your representative and go, why did you make that decision? And I always get met right. with, well, you don't know what was going on behind the scenes. Well, why don't you tell me?
Yeah, and it's amazing to think about, you know, how quote unquote bad the problem was in 1986 versus now. You know, it's just a world of difference.
Yeah, yeah, it is. So from a historical perspective, though, I mean, you know, I always hear that we're a nation of immigrants. The original colonists were they were settlers, and there is a difference right. there. So from sure. and I don't think we really didn't have much immigration. I think until the waves of the Italians, the Polish, the Irish coming over, but there wasn't a lot before that.
Well, I think the real difference to draw is that because there was throughout the 19th century, you had the Germans and you had the Irish,
yeah.
and then like you're talking about more the turn of the century, the Italians mm-hmm. and other people from Eastern Europe. But the difference in all of those cases, there was no mm-hmm. welfare state.
Yeah.
That's the difference. People got yeah. here, and the people who succeeded because they were able to stay here succeeded because they were able to rise up and offer something to their community, to the country, and make something of themselves. And that's the all-important part of the equation that's been missing.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem to come up in the conversation because I remember my ancestors came from Sicily and from mm-hmm. from Poland and from Ireland, and I know on the Sicilian side they didn't speak Italian in the house, unless it was right. Christmas Eve and Aunt Jenny and Aunt Sophie had too much Chianti. But other than that, they spoke English, and right. then they would fight each yeah. other. They would fight with each other in Italian.
I have great grandparents yeah. who arrived in the 1890s from Austria, and. Yeah, same goes. They weren't arriving because they knew there was some sort of welfare package and right. housing package and SNAP benefits that they were going to partake of. None of that existed.
And they were here because of the grand experiment and the idea that is America and the American dream. Yeah, you're right. That is a big difference in it. It seems to be left off the table when we're discussing it. Yeah. Okay, well, let's go ahead and take our last break. And then I want to wrap up and find out kind of some stuff that you've got going on, James. And then if we have time, I want to talk about fonts. Fonts are really important, apparently. So hopefully we'll get to that. Again, we're talking with James Masnoff. You're listening to Newsmakers at Noon on 1430 KYKN.
Now back to the Rich Duncan Construction Newsmakers at Noon with Denison Hunter, presented by Hagen Hamilton Insurance on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers at Noon is brought to you by Color Tile of Salem and Cozy's New York Deli.
Alrighty, we're wrapping up our conversation today. Dispatches from the Swamp with James Masnoff. So, James, you are a PhD student at the moment.
Yes,
Columbian, but that's going to change.
Distinguished fellow. Yeah,
you're a distinguished fellow. Well, I think so.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying that's my title as mm-hmm. PhD student / teaching assistant because I also yeah. teach college mm-hmm. classes on Fridays as part of mm-hmm. my duties at George Washington University in DC. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the next 5-6 months is my comprehensive exams, my comprehensive readings and then exams, which is reading 200 works of history between January and May of this next year, and then doing my exams to prove that I've done so.
Are these assigned to you? Do you pick them? How's this list compiled?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a mix of the two. I have two minor fields and a major field. The two minor fields are 50 to 75 books, and then the major field is 100 to 125 books. And then I have a historian who's sort of my direct advisor for that specific field. So as you know, one of my big interests is constitutional history. So mm-hmm. one of my minor fields is constitutional history. I have another minor field, 1877 to the present. So I have a good handle of the sort of quote-unquote modern history. And then my major field is like the early republic, early national period. So mm-hmm. Basically colonial America through the revolution on up to 1877 is my major field. And Say with that one, my advisor is like, well, here's, you know, a bunch of the books you should read.
Mm-hmm.
Here are sort of the major contributions, the major historians in the field. And then what else are you interested in that would fit? And so we sort of negotiate a list and then it gets finalized. And all of that took place in the past several months.
Okay. Now, go ahead, Hunter.
I was just going to say, so James has got his library card because he is going to be spending plenty of time there
so
as
question
well.
Question then, are yes. you, because I am a, give me a paper book. I want to open up, turn the pages. I like tactile, the thing about that. I'm a very fast reader, so I can get through them a lot. Are you a pretty quick, I mean, I'm assuming you are. I mean, you've got to fit in reading. You can't just plop yourself down in an easy chair and spend your days reading. You got other stuff to do.
Sure. I've had to become a fast reader. I'm naturally a very slow reader because I'm pretty deliberate and I want to make sure I'm absorbing everything. By necessity, I've sped that up over the years. I'll be reading. I sort of mapped it out. So to make it all work in the timeline necessary, I'll be reading about 8 books every week.
Wow. So. Yeah, and that's the thing. I know especially when you're dealing with really weighty topics and meaty subjects, you want to be able to slow down. I can, you know, read nonfiction or fiction rather, and knock that out in a weekend for a lot of stuff. But yeah, some other stuff, you really want to kind of slow down and absorb it. So
And some of my duties don't go away either. I'm still a teaching assistant. So as we've talked about before, I'm a teaching assistant in the spring for this class called Why We Fight About Politics. So I'll still be sitting in on those full lectures 2 days a week and then teaching my own classes of that course on Fridays. So balancing those things, you know, gets pretty tricky.
Yeah. Well, and then like we said, because coming up January 1, happy birthday, America, 250 years. So do you have... Did your focus shift a little bit? I mean, and again, like talking when we opened the show, we're talking about the Ken Burns documentary, which is bringing more eyeballs and more interest on our founding and the revolution and everything else. Are you going to spend more time in focusing on that as we head into the 250th anniversary?
I am. And it's kind of coincidental. I couldn't have planned this better, honestly, that I would be I've already done one of my minor field readings, my constitutional history readings I've already done. I'll be doing my 1877 to the present for the first month or so of the year. And then thereafter is that field, is colonial America, revolutionary America, early republic, is the field I'm going to be focusing on the most over the next several months. And it just so happens to be the anniversary of, you know, the Declaration and the United States. So it's just really sort of kismet. But I'm definitely taking advantage of it. And my wife and I are planning to stay put during the summer because there's going to be so many events going on here celebrating the 250th.
Oh,
and we're trying to get our family to come out and see us because it's going to be a really exciting time to be here.
Yeah, I bet. And I haven't, with, you know, sort of with Trump in the White House, a renewed sense of real patriotism. And again, it's not just on the right. You're right. There are folks that are classical liberals, absolutely patriotic, love the country. And I'm glad you made that point earlier. What other stuff have you got going on? Any extracurricular activities? Because you got so much time on your hands, James.
Well, as part of that, it's we haven't made it up to Philadelphia yet. So whether it's just a personal trip, my wife and I, or if I can kind of like fold it into something related to my readings or something related to my, you know, PhD program, I'd really like to go up to the National Constitution Center as well as Independence Hall in Philly. It's one of those things. And Independence Hall and Philadelphia broadly will be one portion of my dissertation. So after all of this is over in the next 6 months, that's when I then turn toward researching and writing my dissertation, which will then be another 3 years of work.
Okay. Any chance you're going to get up to New England, the Boston area? Because I'm sure there's going to be just a plethora of activities and celebrations.
That's also what I'm hoping. I'm going to have maybe a few weeks in the summer free before I then have to shift to writing my prospectus for my dissertation. If that time ends up being for real, that's what I'm hoping, is that maybe we can jump up to Philly and maybe even up to Boston, because I would love to be there for some of those.
I'm actually going to be on the Cape in June. And so we got to fly into Logan. So I want to spend at least a day poking around there. It's been a long time since I've been there and really poked around Boston. Like I said, I grew up there. So for the bicentennial, all of our field trips were there. Tiny little people on the USS Constitution. Those bunks were small. It was great. It was wonderful in the history of it all. So I think that's great. And if you can get up there, I think you'll thoroughly enjoy it. And it's beautiful in the summer. So there you go. So I don't know what is anything going on the West Coast. I hope so. It just seems to be so East Coast centric for a lot of
I really hope so. A later mission of mine is to try to bridge the two coasts. Something I'd like to do later, a few years from now, is start a nonprofit that would bring college students, say from Chemeketa or from other schools in the Salem area, over to the DC area, like over a week, maybe do that once a year. Because I do feel like that there's a sort of chasm and that people there on the West Coast should be able to feel closer, sort of sentimentally, with the American founding than they often do.
It's in the architecture. It's just go spend time in an old cemetery and you really start looking. And I had a lot of friends who would do the headstone rubbings and all that kind of stuff. Because you're looking, 1400s and headstones, and then it just tells the tale of Sarah Goodbody and four of her children that die. I mean, it's fascinating. You can get a lot of that history, that personal history, and then the old sort of the clapboard houses, and I love that. I miss New England actually for a lot of that, so I'm looking forward to going back.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here in Virginia too, I did some research at an archive in Richmond, and when I did, I also went over to Christ Church, where Patrick Henry gave his Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech. Mm-hmm. And that's also where George Wythe, a really important founder, is also buried. And it's just all over around here.
Yeah. You can just really soak it in. And it's a different vibe than reading about it or watching a documentary, frankly.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm going to do it. We're going to switch over to fonts because this is a big deal. Come on now. So I love this headline, Serifs Strike Back. Rubio rejects Biden's DEI-driven font agenda. Calibri was canceled. Times New Roman, back in all its serif glory, was reinstated, 14 points in all. Bravo. I'm for it.
I'm for it. Now, do you want to tell people who don't know what serifs are, what that means?
Well, it's the tail on the T's and the I's and the L's, and it gives it gravitas, whereas a sans serif doesn't have that. So think, Comic Sans.
it's really boring.
And Calibri and another ones, they're very, very, they're supposedly easier to read. And so it's kind of like you're sort of dumbing down the fonts. So I was happy to see this. It seems sort of inconsequential, but fonts matter.
Yeah, I hadn't known about Biden's policy of doing the sans serif thing, but like, I have tended to like Trump's reforms anyway, but this is like at the top of my list. Like, this is great.
This is the number one.
Well, we can always we can always shut out the next generation by just changing our font to cursive wherever we go.
Indeed.
Oh, let's go full Wingdings. No one will know what we're talking about. No one will know. So I was happy to see this. Apparently it was accessibility, but whatever. James, we're out of time. We're going to miss talking to you for a little while. You're going to have your hands full, so we appreciate that. Best of luck to you. Always, always great to talk to you, and we'll catch up later. All right, everybody, that is it for us. Go out, enjoy the weekend. We will see you on Monday.
This has been the Rich Duncan Construction Newsmakers at Noon with Denise and Hunter, presented by Hagen Hamilton Insurance. Live local talk that matters to you. Exclusively on 1430 KYKN, where Salem is listening.